Okay.
All right. So thanks so much, Jillian, for joining me here on the Culture Builders podcast. Why don't you start by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself and your background?
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for having me as well. I'm really excited. I love talking about culture. It's one of those topics that I find you can get really, really, really excited and into. It's a great bar talk topic as well. So I'm excited to be here. A little bit about myself. I currently work for a company called Mindbridge. I'm the director of transformation and customer success there. The reason why I joined Mindbridge, an AI company, is actually because I am really passionate about helping people. And that's why I actually went in to really work specifically with an AI company. So a bit about kind of my background. My background's in change management, adoption, transformation, business strategy, and mixed with this passion of how people work in organizational psychology and all those kind of behavioral pieces that bring together it all. So that's a little bit about my background. Prior to Mindbridge, I worked at IBM. And I also had lots of opportunities to practice some other type of consulting in different engagements. And outside of work, I'm a big passionate endurance athlete. I love getting outside. I'm lucky enough to live in Ottawa, close to Gatineau Park. And I also have various creative outlets, whether it's painting or baking or lots of other different things, just to help me kind of create space through creativity.
And you're telling me you got on the bike for the first time this last weekend?
Yeah, I did. So we were just chatting before, and it's the first weekend that's really warm, and then also one of the first weekends since kind of COVID started that we had a little bit less restriction. So I was super excited. Got out, Gatineau Park opened up for the first time for cyclists, and I think I may have overdone it a bit, but it was a good first ride.
Well, good for you. And we're here on May 25th. So really, like you said, it's, you know, it's one of the, I feel like we're starting to feel a little bit of normalcy now in a way where this like new normal, this is like the new normal. If, at least for me, it's felt that way. And you mentioned change and change management, like how, what's it like, you know, in an organization right now with so much change? And maybe first of all, you can explain a little bit about like what does change management mean to you?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I actually like to think of change management as really just change. So just kind of primarily at its core. And when I think about change management and transformation, I mean, one, change is really the new constant, you know, the little bit of a paradox there in terms of our worlds are evolving and transforming so quickly that we actually, you know, staying in the status quo is just not normal anymore. It's not a way that we can continue to thrive in this world. So we have to continuously adapt and find ways to do that in a way that allows us to really have growth and continuous improvement. So when I think about change and transformation, I actually really think about breaking it down to four big building blocks. So at the core of really having effective change within your organization or effective transformation, I really believe you need kind of four key things. So the first one is leadership. And there's lots of elements of what goes into leadership really there, but really having that change leadership, you know, resiliency, ability to adapt, ability to pivot, ability to understand your core values that you can hold on to. So that leadership piece. The second element is strategy. So understanding your business strategy and how your business strategy relates to those core values and how your business strategy and relates to also the direction that you've been giving your team. So understanding your business strategy. That also ties in at the end with understanding ROI. I find that when I talk about change, a lot of times people say, oh yeah, change. But you know, how do I get the ROI out of it? So it's a good connection as well. So leadership strategy. The third one is engagement. So understanding how you actually create a good stakeholder experience, whether that's an employee experience, a customer experience, or, you know, another stakeholder experience. How do you really get engagement and how do you build an experience so that whatever change you're going through actually creates long-term change to behaviors that you're looking for? And then the last one is execution. So that's kind of the project management side of change. And honestly, my experience with this is that people spend a lot of time on the execution piece. What's the project management? Give me the 12-step process. Give me the, you know, deliverables. Like, let me finish these exact things that I have to do. And less time on the strategy, or less time on the leadership, less time on the engagement. But you still need those operational pieces to make sure that your transformation or your change initiative goes through on time. So those are the four elements. That's how I like to break them down. And I feel like if you can build those building blocks, you can actually take them and then adapt them to whatever project, scenario, context, environment that you're in to be able to effectively transform your organization.
Interesting. And you've worked in many different organizations that are different sizes and have different cultures. How would you say it differs on the type of organization or the size, or do you find that those four are constant?
Oh, great question. So I believe the four building blocks, leadership, engagement, execution, and strategy are all the same in terms of you need those four building blocks, but how you execute them will vary depending on your context, the organization, the situation you're in. And they're all going to have varying degrees. I mean, you might already be in a situation where there's only a few of you. It's a collaborative environment. You've already got all the engagement you need, you know, and it's just natural. Versus you might be in a very large organization that's not traditionally had a stakeholder experience focus and haven't really had really positive change results. And, you know, it might be the first time you're going through this and saying, hey, we really have to put an effort to do more engagement, to do more outreach, to bring people into the change, to help them make decisions. So it kind of just depends on, I believe you need those four building blocks, but absolutely the depth and, you know, the strategy that you will take in each of those buckets will vary depending on your organization and your context, for sure.
Okay. And you talked about leadership. And it's interesting because you wrote a blog post about leading during chaos or leading in through chaos. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so that blog post was a purely selfish blog post. I was sitting down, and I believe it was the end of week one of our work from home COVID, and I was observing a lot of things going on. So I was sitting there and I was observing, hey, you know what? We were really quick to mobilize. We were really quick to get our employees safe. But I was starting to see the business community react differently. I was starting to see the business community kind of move beyond, okay, our people are safe. We're quick to do that in only a few days, and moving very quickly into, okay, what's this going to mean for the economy? And you know, how are we going to manage uncertain times? And I was watching these things happen, and it was all, or at the same time, there's all these speculations. I mean, really early on, end of March. And I sat there and I was trying to ask myself, what can I do right now to provide the most value back to my organization? I was struggling a little bit. The other thing I was struggling with is that I was traditionally in a very collaborative environment at work. And I was traditionally in a very collaborative environment with my leadership team. And what kind of happens when you get into a bit of a crisis is that you actually start to bring the decision-making group down into a manageable size that you can quickly make decisions. So if you're in a very collaborative environment normally where almost everybody is discussed and talked to, and all of a sudden you have to bring and shrink that down, you actually have people outside who are, you know, in my case, I'm director, that are now not necessarily in the really big high level decisions that you have to quickly make at the top, you know, in the C-level executive suite. So I sat there and I said, you know, how can I help this? How can I help my team? How can I help my organization? How can I lead up? How can I lead down? How can I lead out? And so I started to put together some of the principles. That's where the blog came from. One of the things I did is I reached out to a peer group that I have. Most of them are much higher up than I am, you know, C-level mm-hmm. executives, VP-level executives. And I just asked them a really simple question of, what do you need from your teams right now? You know, and they are not, by the way, they are not in my organization. I actually only reached out to one individual in my organization. I made sure I had someone from healthcare, someone from not-for-profit, like kind of around the spectrum. And the responses I got back were amazing. I mean, they were just so incredibly rich in terms of, you know, a lot of them kind of came and said, you know, one, I need you to make sure that you're all right and tell me if you're not. You know, they talked about the decision-making, how the funnel had to get smaller, but how you can impact their decision-making. So what they needed, you know, is really clear information. They needed to know, if you're on the front line with a customer, they need to know what customers are feeling right now. So they need information. Mm-hmm. So all of this kind of stuff came out of me just asking that one question. And it formed what I felt was this really great blog on areas that you can, as a leader, no matter where you are in your organization, even if you're not the C level, you can actually help to navigate the storm. So that's a bit of the background of it. And it's, I think it's actually a really great framework. It really helped me. And then as I got it out there into the world, I had a lot of really good feedback come back to me about it.
Great. And people can find that on LinkedIn just by going to your profile. We'll share a link also in the description of the podcast so people can read it too. It was a great post. And I love how you talked about the idea of leading up, down, and across the organization. And it kind of goes to my belief around culture. But I'd love to understand more, what does it mean to you to build culture in an organization?
Yeah, that's a great question. And obviously the premise of this podcast as well. So the way that I like to describe culture is, I really believe that culture is what happens when no one's looking. So it's the water cooler talk, you know, it's the Slack channel, it's the behaviors that people do when they're comfortable in their own skin within an organization. And culture runs really, really, really deep in an organization. And it runs in all the places you wouldn't look, but you can feel it. You know, that's what I think of culture. So when I think about building culture, I really think about norms and behaviors, but I also think about how people react to certain things and what feels comfortable and what environment feels comfortable. So how can you build culture within an organization? One of the things I come back to a lot, and I talk about it in the blog as well, and I come back to it a lot in change, is really understanding and living by the core values of the organization. And there's actually some research out there that shows that if you disagree with the core values of your organization, you might actually have some friction with your organization and you might not feel so comfortable. So that might be one of the reasons why you may not feel comfortable at work. But when we talk about core values, they're really something that you can hold on to and pivot to, and they help to drive the behaviors in your organization. Most importantly, in a time of chaos, they actually are the one thing you can anchor onto. So what doesn't change, you know, when the whole world's changing? Well, what might not change for an organization is that we want to be a trusted advisor to our client. So even though the world is changing and how we do business and everything's uncertain, at the core of it, we still need to be a trusted advisor to our client. That's at our core values. Or integrity. Integrity doesn't change even if the world goes into a pandemic. You know, or trust, or driving exceptional experiences. You know, those things don't change. The way we do them maybe changes, but those core values don't change. So when you're building a culture within your organization, and everyone can do that, I mean, living by those core values, demonstrating those core values, if integrity is a core value of your organization, or authenticity, you know, how are you living by those? By even, you know, the feedback you're giving, or the respect you're doing, or, you know, the information you're bringing up. If driving exceptional customer experiences, how are you helping to do that? Are you bringing forward innovative ideas to drive better experiences? Or are you making sure that you're getting the data into the operation system so that you can understand data trends on where people are finding value in your experience? Like, those are all things that you can do. And it's what you can ground yourself to. So I think that's a big element to it.
It's so interesting that you talk about, like, it's not just the good times, but also in the bad times where those values are tested, right?
Absolutely. So 3 months ago, I had written a blog that I have not posted because I have to reframe it. But I wrote a blog that was draft that was about the world seems to be moving really fast, but we were in a time of growth. So it was the exact same premise. It was, everything's moving, everyone's growing. And it was in the premise of AI and accounting, because that's where I work. And it was about, okay, if everything's moving and all of a sudden I need to have all these tools in accounting, you know, what can I hold on to? Well, the world's moving so fast and growing so fast. And it was core values. You want to be a trusted advisor to your client, ask yourself, what do you need to offer an amazing service and be able to offer being a trusted advisor while, you know, the world continues to add more data and we start doing all of our transactions digitally and all those things. The exact same premise happens now. It's just a different frame. It's now, we're not in the state of growth. We're now in a state of uncertainty. But you still go back and hold on to those core values. That's really at the core of it. So it's just a different premise, but it's the exact same building blocks and thought process.
And you worked in Alberta, right? Around the time of, I think it was 2014 during the oil crisis and the crash, right? What was that like? Because that must have been really testing, right?
Yeah. So that was an interesting experience. That was one of the projects I was on in my earlier consulting careers. And we were out in Alberta right when I remember we started the project and, you know, the barrel was well over $100 a barrel. And then a couple months in, it felt like it crashed overnight. It was an interesting experience. I think it helped to prepare me. Any of those experiences help to prepare, you know, for future experiences where you find you have these dips. Previous to that, I think my biggest experience, I was in university during the 2008 crash. So although I kind of felt it, I didn't really. I was a student. I was a bit protected. It was my first real experience when I was on the job where I showed up and, you know, half of the team was uncertain about their job, and every week you'd kind of have somebody drop off the project, and you'd walk around and, you know, restaurants would be half empty and things like that. You know, the experience that kind of happened. And actually the interesting thing was I was living in Ontario at the time. And so you come to Ontario and people would be like, yeah, cheap gas prices. And then you'd fly back to work and you're like, ooh, this is not feeling so good. I think what I take back from that experience was just really thinking of it as a case study of, what was the communications like there? We actually had really great leadership on our side that was really supportive, really great partners that were really supportive, that, you know, talked us through things, that, you know, were open to us about these things. And so I try to go back and think about, you know, what were some of the lessons I learned? And as well, you know, that we were able to regain traction, you know, afterwards. I was able to move on to different projects. And so how do you kind of work through those? So kind of taking some of those experiences where I could and the lessons I can. Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting. And I mean, you've had a lot of different lessons too, working. You mentioned that you worked in a few different countries internationally. What was that like? And I guess, did you, like, what did you find? I'm really curious to dig deeper on, like, what, how different the, you know, creating culture at work can be depending on where you are in the world.
Oh, yes. Yeah. That's a great question. I think if anyone's taken a business class on cross-cultural business or anything, you learn about all these different, you know, high context, low context cultures, but you really got to live it to believe it. I had one project where I was working with a team in Argentina, and it was a great example of just, you know, a completely different type of culture, in terms of, they really had a family type of culture. They really loved to bring people into conversations. I remember us having friction because we would have kind of a set guideline of like a very set project plan, and they would kind of be like, "Wow, you know, we want to do it this way," kind of thing. And they were brilliant people to work with, absolutely. But we just had a very different style when it came to the managing, and we actually had to learn each other's style. One of the more, I think, real examples and recent examples. I was very fortunate in 2018. I got to do a bit of a give back project in Senegal. So it was when I worked for IBM at the time, and they have an incredible program called the CSC program. And I was able to go there. It was for just over 4 weeks on the ground where I was working with, we had 15 different IBMers from around the world. And we were there, we were working with the Ministry of Education on this give back project. So we're bringing together all of our skills, and it was like incredible skill sets that were available. That was such an interesting project because not only did we have to learn the Senegalese culture, which was, you know, quite an experience on its own. I mean, the way that they go about even like meetings is very different. I mean, you need twice as long to have a meeting because of greetings and because of length. The way they go around linear, we used to say time is not linear in Senegal. It's really go with the flow. And their commitment to their own core values, their commitment to their family and things like that. But we also had to learn the culture of everyone else in the team. So there's 15 of us. I believe it was 12, maybe 13, but I believe it was 12 different countries. And each of those countries had a different culture. Even myself, compared to my US colleagues, have a different culture. So we actually had to, within our own fifth group of 15, had to figure out how to work with each other. And that was really, really quite a test of our own patience and our own ability to kind of open up. And once we were able to get over, you know, I think that initial storming phase, you could really see the value and the richness of the diversity that was there. But it did take actually a little bit of time for us to get over that initial kind of storming phase. And it's not just because there's new people in the room. It was actually because we literally had so many different cultures that were sitting there. I think there was nine primary languages, if I can remember correctly. And English was the main common language, although obviously not primary. Sometimes English was like someone's third or fourth language. And then French was the local language. So we also had that as well. So it was an interesting situation.
Wow. Yeah, that's very interesting. And I mean, I think it's amazing to see how fast people can adapt in such a short period of time, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it was that was a rapid project. I still look back at what we accomplished and all the deliverables we pumped out, and it was crazy. But very quickly people could adapt. I think it only took us really, I mean, not very long to kind of get together. The beautiful thing of it, and one of the reasons why we were able to get there so quickly, though, was because we actually had very similar core values. Everybody was there to, mm-hmm. one, to help and give back. Everybody also identified with, everyone was at least an IBMer at the time, you know, so they kind of identified with something. But really they identified with, we are here on a once in a lifetime journey, and we want to be open. And one of the reasons why we're here is to also meet everybody here. So we all kind of shared that, and we all shared gratitude. Every single person on the team was incredibly grateful. And if you ever had any kind of bad day, you know, you didn't have to look very far. So having those core values really grounded us, and they helped us get through that storming phase quite quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, adaptability is so important, and being able to learn on the fly. And I mean, you were telling me before that you had done your EMBA at the age of 25. And maybe you can tell me a little bit about, and our listeners, about, you know, the decision to do your MBA at the time. And how this kind of impacted your career, because it sounds like, you know, it did have a positive impact, at least.
So I went back to school about 5 years after graduating, or a little bit less than 5 years after graduating. I went into an EMBA program not because I thought that I was an executive, but because I really felt like the actual program structure was the right program structure for me. And also because at that point I had been doing consulting, and I accelerated through my career a bit. So I felt I was leading a lot of projects, and I felt like I wanted to learn from every person in the room. And someone had once told me, like, if you're the smartest person in the room, get out of the room. Like, what are you doing in there? Mm-hmm. So I felt like, you know, if I could get into this program, which I was nervous at first, then, man, I could learn. There's like 32 or 33 other people in there who were all executives that I could just people watch for 2 years and soak in all of their knowledge. That was one of the reasons why I did it, and why I pushed to get into that program. On top of that, it had a very hands-on structure to it, and it had a lot of opportunities for me to actually consult outside of my regular job in different areas that I didn't have confidence I knew how to consult in. So there was also that element of kind of pushing myself out of my boundaries. The one thing that stands out for me, I mean, there's so many parts of the program that were incredible, But the big thing that stands out for me is actually something that happened within the first couple of weeks. So I walked into this program very nervous. I was literally 25 years old when I walked in. I also look, you know, at that time, I look like I was probably more like 18. So, you know, I've still considered to be ID'd all the time. So I knew I was walking into a very interesting place, as well as half the people in the room had children my age. So there was a little bit of that as well. And I remember, you know, I continuously repeated a few words constantly over my first couple of days. And they were, I start every conversation with, I know I'm young, I know I'm female, I know I'm, you know, I don't have very much experience, but I can tell you this. And that's how I started every time I like would say something or raise my hand or sit with my team, I would start with this like, you know, big claim of who I was. And I was this young female in my head, a blonde, you know, person who had no experience. What the heck was I doing here? But I have something to add. And I finally had someone pull me aside, actually my director, the director of the program pulled me aside and was like, are you done yet? Like, are you done? are you done saying this? Like, can you stop? Can you just stop saying it? And she's like, you have to own it. Like, you just have to own it and you have to stop saying it, because every time you say it, you diminish yourself. So what I had to do was take these walls that I had built. I had built being female up in a technical world. I was working for a technical company. I had built being young and looking younger. I had built being blonde. I had built whatever else. The other thing, I'm functional, not technical. I'm not an engineer. So I automatically, you know, I have a business degree. Like, why would someone listen to me? So I built my functional. So I had these like four walls that I was living in. And it took me a while, but it was like basically a transformation of how do I own these? How do I make these walls into pedestals? Pretty quickly, I was able to do that, because pretty quickly it became obvious that people actually started looking to me in the room to answer a lot of questions. So when I didn't have a lot of technical expertise, although I did have more than I thought. I didn't realize how much technical expertise I'd gained by working on so many technical projects. Especially when you're in change management, because you always have to translate technical into people requirements. So you actually learn a lot more than you think you do. But when people actually valued the functional side, it was when employee experience and experience was coming along. So my expertise in consulting and some of my talents were actually really, really valuable. Number two, my age. I had a lot of people pull me aside and said, I wish I was your age when I did this program. You know, what do you have to lose? Like, oh my gosh, everyone's expecting you to make mistakes. Like, you basically have a free pass, like go for it. So, you know, people were just, you know, baffled that I would even, a lot of people told me they were embarrassed, you know, that I would be giving really valuable input. And they're like, man, I'm 20 years older with 20 years more experience. So it made me actually just appreciate my age and appreciate the opportunity in front of me. It did not make me think less of anyone else, by the way. It just made me appreciate my own self. Being female, I think that was actually something that I had to kind of acknowledge and say, you know what, this is a really good time to be a female who wants to be in leadership. It's actually a really good time. We're in a state of transformation, and I can continue to be a voice, and I can help people my age figure out and navigate the path. So I might as well do that. And then the last one, you know, the kind of the, you know, who I am, I'm a bit of a bubbly type person, and that maybe seems like it takes my intelligence down, but I know that what I say is solid. And also I love to dress up. I love to feel good. And I should own that. I should own who I am. I shouldn't worry about it. So basically, how do I take those walls and transfer them into pedestals and stand on top of them and say, yeah, I'm a young, you know, functional, you know, female leader, and I can't wait to work with you. Let's go. You know, it was kind of basically how I had to translate it. That was a big piece, and all the other stuff I learned, massive improvements. But I think that confidence alone was something I was missing. And I think I would have got there, but it would have taken me a lot longer probably if I wasn't forced into it.
Interesting. People, I've heard, you know, we've got this idea of diversity and inclusion, but like belongingness is this kind of new piece that's been brought to the table recently. And it makes me think of that, right? Like you had that feeling of belongingness after. And so, you know, kudos to that professor for coming up to you and, you know, and saying that to you. But
Yeah, it's true.
What an interesting experience. I'm curious, what do you think about, what do you think about education in a time of COVID? Or would you, have you considered any further education, or would you consider any further education?
Oh my goodness. I honestly think education is an investment. Yeah. I've never looked at it any other way. I think there is a great question about, especially depending on the program you're doing, it can be very expensive. So you might want to be looking at those pieces. But education, I mean, there's so many alternatives to education right now. And there's lots of ways that you can learn. I am jealous of people who get to learn, and who have the opportunity. So I don't think I'll ever be in a position where I feel like education isn't a good investment. What I think is important, though, is that you yourself, you get what you put into it ultimately at the end of the day, right? So you yourself have to want to learn, and that's what's going to drive the best results for everybody. But absolutely, there's so many great things, even free master classes, or like everyone's learning new skills lately too, which it's interesting. I feel like in a way people have unleashed a bit more creativity in COVID. You see people cooking new things and trying new moves, and it's cool. I think it's really, really cool.
Cool. And I saw you posted about, you wrote a post on LinkedIn about AI and humans, and the human and the machine, and kind of cultural change, I guess specifically, within accounting or working in this field, it's hard to change. Change is not easy, especially, in this world of AI and humans. But maybe you can talk about that a little bit more and how you see these kind of two worlds merging.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a really fabulous book out there called AI Superpowers. It's a little bit of a scary read, to be honest. There's a lot of scary reads out there, but I've read several books over the last couple of years on this topic, and that one, it was very well articulated in many ways. I just feel like it's a great book if people are looking to kind of pull those together, because in the second part of the book, he really actually brings out human and the machine and how it's a superpower together. He also talks about organizations that are superpowers within AI, kind of the top ones out there. So that's why it's a bit of a scary read. But in general, we're looking at these emerging technologies and we are, it baffles my mind and it scares me to look at, where we're going to be in a couple of years. And then even scarier to think of where we're going to be in 10, 20, 30, 40 years. And the projections, I mean, they're a bit like COVID projections where they're a bit uncertain, but they're still, kind of based on some level of data and accuracy. So the question isn't whether or not, we're going to get there. The question is really a time of when we're going to get there. At that time, what policies and things will be in place to shape how it looks. So when I think about AI and machines, I mean, there's a lot of really great examples and you can look at, there's actually a really great documentary on DeepMind and things that you can watch to just kind of see how powerful some of these new tools are. But there's quite a bit of evidence that shows that, human versus human in, let's say, a game of chess, obviously you're going to have a winner of a human versus machine in a game of chess, machines at this point is far above and can typically be the best human. But human plus machine still has an advantage. So when we look at, emerging technologies, we're looking at ways that we can increase productivity. We're looking at ways that we can better enable humans. We're looking at ways that we can automate, maybe specific tasks that don't necessarily, that actually from a human capacity perspective, really are going to become too large for us to do. We're talking about data sets and things like that. So a lot of it is understanding how a human and machine can actually work together to really be enabled and to really kind of move the productivity line forward. It's an interesting, crazy debate because there's a lot of there's a lot of impacts to it, right? There's going to be massive impacts, and there's going to be massive amounts of reskilling that are going to be required. And it's going to make us think differently. You know, we're going to have to think about, you know, how can we continue to provide value? And I think one of the things that I always come back to when people say, you know, it's going to take over all of our jobs or things like that, I come back often to remember that human plus machine is really powerful together. And think of yourself, think of what are things that a machine can't do very easily. You know, think of things that are like innately human. So, you know, intuition, creativity, you know, curiosity, like those are all things that really at our core are very human nature, human centric. It's valuable for us to think about those skills is going to be increasingly more valuable. When we talk about our own software in our own company, you know, we often talk about us really providing a tool, but we're not taking away the curiosity or the judgment of our users. In fact, that is what they are the best at. That is really their value, is really to kind of go in and interpret and understand. You know, so I think that's kind of another way of looking at it as well.
Wow. And that shift in mindset to understanding that, like, how would you recommend that leaders or just people in organizations can kind of shift their culture to embrace to a culture of embracing this, as opposed to just being like, you know, this is going to destroy everything, right?
So to be honest, my real advice is to come back to what we talked about earlier, which is your core values. So let's talk about being able to be a trusted advisor. If that's one of your core values, your rock, in a financial world that has increasing more data every single day and is beyond human capacity to be able to kind of go through. How do you continue to be a trusted advisor? You know, you need tools to be able to do that. And think about technology really as a tool, as an enabler. So if you have an organization that is saying, you know, I don't, you know, it's going to wipe out my jobs or whatnot, you might ask them, just flip the question back on them. Okay, let's pull up your core values. You say you want to be a trusted advisor. How do you plan to continue being this trusted advisor as your client's world continues to change?
Yeah.
You know, and you know, there's certainly, you can wade through that water a little bit, but at one point it's just going to be too deep. You know, and you're going to find that there's going to be people who tried to wade through the water and then they're going to be stuck. So, that's one conversation you can kind of come back to is really, if we really do truly want to be, or, you know, you often see organizations who say they want to be innovative or value driven or all of these questions. It's okay. Well, how are you going to continue to do that as your clients' organizations change? And that's more valid than ever right now with COVID. Now, you know, you get lots of other resistant pieces, you know, there's lots of investment required. There's a lot of skill set required too. That's going to be a big piece of like reskilling or bringing in new talent. There's all of those barriers and it's not easy. It's not a one day flip the switch. But I mean, that's at its core, that's a lot of where you have to start.
And you mentioned before that you have a lot of experience working from home, right? Or working remotely, let's say. Yeah. And I guess this hasn't been much of a change for you, really, given some of the experience you've had, regardless of everything else going on in the world. But I mean, what's it been like for you? And do you have any advice to those of us that you know, might have been, you know, might be new to this remote work culture?
Yeah, well, I feel like by now, hopefully people have found a groove and settled in. For me, it's a lot about just making sure that I feel good. So I think it goes back to that old quote of, you can't give what you don't have. And if you don't feel good or you don't have energy, like you can't give energy to your team, you can't give kind of your best. So a lot of it for me is actually, I keep a very similar structure to my day, regardless of the fact that I work from home. So I still get up and I still do a workout in the morning. You know, I make sure that I change my clothes. So I'm not just in my sweats all day, but I actually change my clothes physically. And sometimes I change my clothes after 5 p.m. just to like feel like I've changed, you know, finished my work day. It's also about being conscious that I'm eating healthy. So a big thing is that it's really easy to kind of just pull those snacks out, but you know, you want to make sure that you are eating healthy and that you're not getting kind of big energy lags through the day. And so those are a couple items. I think when it comes to working with your teams as well, it's also an understanding of what can be really exhausting too from working from home. So I will be honest, there's a few days where I, you know, 5 o'clock came and I had a few Zoom calls with my friends and I said, I can't do another Zoom call. Like, I'm exhausted staring at screens all day. I'm either staring at my computer, I'm staring at my phone. I'm not walking between meetings. I'm barely, you know, walking in and out of the room. I haven't really had any fresh air today. I need to completely disconnect. And one thing I noticed actually was when I was going to the office, I would have, you know, 30 minutes in the morning and usually 45 minutes at night to just kind of decompress my day. And then that would be my switchover. So how do I have one of those switchovers still? I still need it. I still need a way to decompress. I can't just, you know, go just act fluidly. So part of it was, okay, I need to shut off the Zoom meeting. I need to get away from my cell phone. I just need to get away from screens. And for me, it's been a lot of like making sure I have a walk every night. You know, I try to get out close after 5, but at some point I just need to get out of the house and just walk for 30 or 40 minutes to have that decompressed time. Or to, you know, put on a podcast or something, just like flip my brain. So those are a couple of key things. There's lots of really great tips and tricks out there around, you know, how to have collaborative sessions online and how to keep people engaged and communicated to and all those kind of things. But those are the top items for me for sure.
Great. And yeah, you wrote a post about mindfulness. I know that, you know, like you said, taking care of your mind and your body is so important, especially in a time like this where, you know, there can be so much added stress and anxiety in the world, right? So we'll share a link to that too. I'm sure, you know, people would love to read about there about that as well. I was curious, are there any books or that you would recommend on change or on culture at all that you'd recommend for our listeners?
Yeah, I wrote down a few. So a couple ones. The one book that actually totally changed my mind. It gave me a lot of insight. I wasn't expecting it. It's a book called Immunity to Change. It's a fantastic book. It's great for both personal change and organizational change. So Immunity to Change. A few other books. I'm currently in the middle of a book called Multipliers right now. So it's Multipliers, How Do You Make Other Leaders, or How the Best Leaders Make Everyone Else Smarter. And it's just a really fantastic read about how you can amplify your team and productivity and culture. I think it's great. I'm only halfway through it, but I really, really loved it. Creativity Inc. is a great one. The founder of Pixar, he writes a fantastic book on culture as well. And the last one I have is Work Rules, which is a book. I believe it was either the senior vice president or vice president of HR at Google wrote Work Rules. And another great one. It's a little bit more of an HR take, but the thing I love about the Google book is, I honestly, because Google has so much data, they talk a lot about the things they tried, and then they have data to prove if it worked or didn't work. So they just have a ton of information, and they share so much of it. And so I love that. And I actually brought it to work a few times and showed a manager and being like, this is what we should do. Look, it's proven that it works at Google. So that's a great one as well. Those are kind of four books I would definitely put on your bookshelf.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Jillian. It was great to have you as a guest on the Culture Builders podcast. I can't wait for our listeners to hear this, and look forward to having you as a guest again, perhaps in 6 months to a year, just to get a follow up and see how you're doing.
Awesome. Thanks. Appreciate it. It was fun.
Thank you.